From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, movie studios may once again be allowed to own movie theaters. So what does that mean for the business and audiences? Then, at just 19 years old, filmmaker Philip Eumanns has made his first movie, Burning Cain, which had him directing actors much older than he is.
It never felt like there was any sort of hierarchy enforced of, you know, them being older or even me being the director and trying to overcompensate. You know, it's such a mutualistic, equal interaction.
And what's it like being the comedian who warms up the audience at TV tapings? All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. For decades, a federal order set ground rules for how movie studios distribute films, making sure that big companies like Paramount and Warner Brothers didn't monopolize the movie theater business. Now, the U.S. Justice Department says those rules are outdated and need to go. Eric Schwartzel has been following the story for The Wall Street Journal, and he says Hollywood has changed a lot since the so-called Paramount decrees were put in place.
It looked a little different in the late 1940s. I mean, the studios really were able to control distribution of movies soup to nuts. They made the movies, but then they often owned the theaters that showed the movies. And we're also talking about a time when a lot of the big theaters were really just one-screen operations. The multiplex had not been invented yet.
So the movie business, in terms of exhibition, has changed a lot since the 1940s. There are now a couple of huge exhibitors, AMC, Regal, and Cinemark, that control about half the screens in the country. But there are also streaming services like Amazon and Netflix and now Disney Plus. How much is the changing landscape affecting the way the Justice Department is looking at this whole issue?
I think it definitely bolsters the case to take the regulations away, right? Because you can say, look, entertainment is now way more than just going to the movie theater that's in town. You're right. You have streaming services, many of which are operated by the studio, showing those movies in the theaters. I think that that definitely bolstered the argument. The other context here is that the Paramount decree has been swept up in the Trump administration campaign to deregulate in general. There are DOJ officials now looking at rules that they might consider antiquated in the music industry as well. There are a couple industries that are being swept up in this larger trend toward deregulating or at least reexamining regulations that might be considered outdated now.
The thing that I found interesting is I looked up a 1940 article from Time magazine that talked about distribution and exhibition. And here's what it said. Every spring, scores of salesmen roar out of 31 U.S. cities to sell some 17,000 theater owners a full year supply of films sight unseen. This is the idea of block booking, that a theater owner would have to agree to show all of a studio's movies, even the duds, along with the good ones. And that seems to be part of what was driving the Justice Department back then.
I think so. And that is one thing I think some of the smaller theaters in the country are worried about, what that might mean, because you're right. It means if you want to get the blockbusters, you might have to show a few duds in between. And if you are counting on getting a big Marvel movie, but you have to stomach a couple months of lousy returns, you know, some of these smaller theaters, especially the independent operators, aren't going to be able to handle that.
In theory, then, if you're an exhibitor and Disney says, I've got this movie, it's called Avengers Endgame.
Avengers!
Assemble.
You got to book it, but you also have to book these other things that may not be quite as good. And if you don't, you don't get Avengers.
That's right. And as you said, about half of the nation's theater screens right now are controlled by three operators, AMC, Regal, and Cinemark. And so they are able to, you know, whether some of these terms, they have such a scale that they're okay. Now it's the smaller operators, and especially drive-in theaters. Drive-in theaters were very vocal whenever the decree was up for examination by the DOJ. The smaller operators, because they don't have that scale, whenever something like block booking comes around, you know, they're not going to be able to negotiate really with any leverage. And the other thing to think about is that not every theater has six or a dozen or 18 screens. Some of them are one or two screen operations. So the prospect of having to show a studio's product, whether you want to or not, can be particularly monopolizing for some of those locations.
We're talking with Eric Schwartzel at the Wall Street Journal about a Justice Department review of what's known as the Paramount Decrees. Nothing has really been officially decided right now, and I want to hear the counterargument, especially the one presented by the National Association of Theater Owners, which represents exhibitors. What is their argument, and why do they want these decrees kept in place?
They want them kept in place because I think the review of these decrees is coming at a particularly vulnerable time for theaters. You have studios that are more powerful than ever because more and more of the box office being concentrated in a smaller number of films, right? So the top five movies this year so far account for some 27% of the annual box office so far this year. So it's become a really top-heavy ecosystem, and that has given the studios that release those films a lot of leverage. And so from the exhibitor's perspective, I think that they're particularly concerned about diversity of product, because if you do institute block booking and you do allow the major studios to fill up a lot of that screen real estate, the independent production companies are going to have a harder time squeezing their movies in.
And is it possible that a major studio like Universal or Warner Brothers could now go out and buy a movie theater chain? Does that make any business sense for them?
They certainly could now. And even in the year since the decree was passed, there were some studios that would buy a theater here and there, right? Like Disney has the El Capitan here in Hollywood and so on. Now, the prospect of a studio buying a major chain, that's a lot of real estate for a studio to have to handle. That's a lot of electricity and overhead. I'm not sure if you're a studio right now, if it makes the most sense, but the Justice Department certainly just made it a lot easier to, if you wanted to.
So now that the Justice Department has made this recommendation, what happens next?
So right now, the Justice Department is going to file a motion in court calling for the termination of these decrees. That'll be the next step in the process, which we should be expecting this week.
Eric Schwartzel reports on the film industry for the Wall Street Journal. Eric, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, 19-year-old filmmaker Philip Eumanns makes an auspicious debut with Burning Cane. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Philip Eumanns was still in high school when he wrote and directed Burning Cane. Editing the film was a learning experience.
The movie is very different. From the first cut that I had, it was, you know, damn near 3 hours for no reason. I love those moments where we're just kind of breathing with people, but I think those first cuts were maybe a touch overindulgent.
Burning Cane is set around a Southern Baptist church in rural Louisiana, not far from where Eumanns grew up in New Orleans. In many ways, it's a personal story for the 19-year-old director.
You know, for me, Burning Cane is a kind of a meditative character piece driven on the themes of, you know, the rigid religious convictions that govern the rural South, you know, because it takes place in a community in rural Louisiana, and we center around three pillar characters, the Reverend Pastor Joseph Tillman, Helen Wayne, who's a churchgoer and accountant for the church, and mother to our other main character, Daniel, played by Dominique McClellan. But the film is about how they're navigating this especially tumultuous point in their lives in a sort of reflection to the fundamentalist religion that they intake. You know, all of that is really sort of a conversation in coexistence with itself.
It feels like there are a couple of characters in this story that don't speak but are central to the story. Mm. One is the place that it's set in, and the other is the institution of the church. Mm. So let's talk about the place itself and about where the story is set and why its setting is so integral to the story you're trying to tell.
Mm. So Burning Cane is set in rural Louisiana, about an hour and a half south of New Orleans, in Lafourche Parish. And we shot on the Lower Valley sugar plantation for most of our stuff down in Lafourche. And I think the fact that it's set in rural Louisiana, I think there's a lot of congruencies in the sort of Southern Baptist ethos that my mom told me about in her life growing up in Lowcountry, South Carolina. You know, I'm from Louisiana, I'm from New Orleans. So setting it within my sort of home state was both kind of an inevitability and also, you know, essential. But I think the place and even the environment of shooting also helped craft an interesting place for my actors, because we weren't close to New Orleans, at least not, you couldn't just go immediately bop, bop. So we were out there in rural Louisiana, and they really had to sort of breathe in the air of what it meant to really be in Laurel Valley day to day.
Church is another big factor in this story, and there's a couple different perspectives on religion. There's scripture, there's what Malcolm Forbes has to say, which becomes part of a sermon, he who dies with the most toys wins. And then there's this idea about the devil, that there is this agency beyond our control that is going to make us do bad things without our assuming responsibility for the actions that we ourselves are doing.
Yes. That's the whole thing, man. I feel like oftentimes we'll blame something on some sort of outside force when we're not really reckoning with the evil that may be within us. And that's what I wanted to do, especially with the way the sermons are sort of outlined in the film. Wendell sort of dances around, you know, that scapegoat within those first two sermons, and still ultimately...
This is Wendell Pierce, your lead actor.
Yes, I lead for Reverend Tillman. Tillman sort of dances around, you know, the evil within us, talking about, you know, in sort of like hinting towards that final sermon where he finally names the devil as this scapegoat, as this emotional scapegoat that he then blames all of our evil doings in.
You gotta say, devil, repeat after me, devil.
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 I will not be corrupted.
I will not be corrupted.
Devil.
Devil.
I will not cheat.
Cheat.
Devil.
Devil.
I will not lie.
I will not lie.
Devil.
To me, I've always felt like the devil was a sort of emotional scapegoat and someone where we weren't really reckoning with what we were really doing to ourselves and the decisions that we were making on our own accords, you know. And so I definitely wanted to talk about that with Burning Cain, and definitely wanted to sort of outline that within those sermons so that by the end of it, you can see where all of the blame gets sort of left to.
And the problem with growing up in the church or any church and having issues with the theology is that it's impossible for most religions to not look at that person as some sort of apostate, that you can't challenge the beliefs without challenging the underlying doctrine.
Exactly. But I feel like that's why I try to make sure that I make it known that my intention with the piece was not to create a judgmental view of it. It was about humanizing them and creating a sort of objective discussion. I did want it to spur on the conversation of looking at it within our community, but within culture in general, but also within the Black community, sort of really, really dissecting religion and its place in our community, and sort of juxtaposing role that I feel like it has, you know. But it's so interesting, you know, you can talk to especially people who have been following, you know, Christianity their entire lives, and especially with people within my family where I would have disagreements or arguments and questions that wouldn't always get answers. But I understand that it's difficult to reckon with something that you've been following your whole life, you know, and that understanding was something that I also think I sort of developed in time, one with making the movie, but also in having conversations with my family and recognize that I think younger members of my family were more open to having the debate and older members were just shutting it down at the start.
We're talking with Philip Eumanns about his film Burning Cain. I want to ask you about music, because there is a lot of music and there's some church music in here that you incorporate into the story. At what point are you starting to hear songs? At what point do they influence the way that you're writing your screenplay?
So that was really early on. So I was listening to so much blues music, man. You know, Robert Johnson was probably the biggest artist that I was listening to. Pretty much the complete recordings was on repeat throughout pretty much most of the writing process.
But the mother than the red.
And then when I started getting some more deeper into gospel music before 1970, you know, looking at a lot of early sort of Negro spirituals that were recorded, I found the Mississippi Blue Spring Baptist Delegation. I wanted to actually use one of their songs in the film, but then I discovered Mary Lou Williams, and the place that I was going to use that Mississippi Blue Spring song, Mary Lou Williams and her album Black Christ of the Andes from 1964 totally switched up my whole thinking.
Saint Martin,
There's a song in the film called St. Martin de Porres that I think is one of the most haunting, almost quasi-medieval in a way, sort of choral records. And I feel like, I think that's probably one of my favorite sequences in the whole film, you know. But the music that I was listening to definitely helped craft the narrative and craft the sort of grit that comes with rural Louisiana, especially with Robert Johnson, and you're thinking about the rural South. It feels sort of just like perfectly congruent, you know, so.
I want to ask you about working with your actors. You're obviously a young filmmaker. This story is personal to you, and you have actors who, you know, could be your dad, could be your mom. What are the conversations that you're having with them about your point of view, and how do they treat you even though you're a young'un?
Well, I think we're all students of the craft, and the camera is a great equalizer, I'd say, because my actors, it never felt like there was any sort of hierarchy enforced of, you know, them being older or even me being the director and trying to overcompensate and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's such a mutualistic, equal interaction, you know, through and through, because we're both trying to make good art. So, and I think everyone that was on the set of Burning Cane wanted to be there because financial incentives were surely not a part of that conversation. So
they're not getting rich making this?
No, it wasn't. That was not even a factor. So it was, we were all there because we were about making good art.
I want to ask about somebody who is not in the movie, but is in the movie. His name is Isaac Webb. Who is Isaac?
Isaac Webb is my instructor from the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. He was the department chair of the Media Arts Department. And I went to NOCA for film. That was my high school. It was a technical sort of film school where after my main academic high school, I would go there and learn technical filmmaking really from 1:15 to 3:45 every day of the week. And Mr. Webb was easily the most formative professor I've ever had, period. I mean, the guy is thoroughly dedicated to promoting the work of his students, really trying to make them better. Mr. Webb is someone I can say through and through is one of the, he's also a good, really good friend of mine now. And I think just through and through, he's one of the most honest, formative professors I've ever had. And he's also a very, very, very respectable filmmaker in his own right, you know, so. And then he also sort of bridged that gap and connected me with, even though I'd already DM'd Ben at that point.
And this is Ben Zeitlin, the director of Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah. So I'd already reached out to Ben at that point over Instagram, and I had gotten in contact with him. But it's crazy. Simultaneously, NOCA was starting to bridge a sort of partnership program with Court 13. So our film program was doing a partnership with them. So shout out to Mr. Webb. He's an amazing dude and an amazing friend.
So you're drawing on family and friends because of the world in which this story is set.
Yeah.
And depending on your point of view, it may not be a flattering depiction of religion and these characters' relationship to faith. So when you take it back to the people who helped make it and you're showing them a story of your view of the church that is meaningful to them,
yeah,
is that awkward? What kind of conversations happen after they see it?
Well, I was definitely afraid for my family to first see the film at Tribeca. I don't know if I should say afraid, but just nervous because I knew that, you know, they're all very religious. A lot of them came up from South Carolina to see it in New York, and the film showcases religious figures in a distinctly fallible light. The conversations aren't black and white. I think it is a little bit easier for some of my family to sort of stomach my differences, given, you know, some of the positive attention that's come around the film and in my voice, you know, but that it really doesn't end, you know. That's I think they recognize that my intention was to humanize and that I did not want to approach it from a judgmental way, but I also can't lie. Like, I have to live my truth and be honest and say, like, this is not what I believe anymore, and I'm just not going to live in fear on that. I can't be apologetic about it because I was being honest from my perspective about the things that I noticed and I wanted to speak on. And I think they recognize that, they respect that. There are still some differences that we have because some of them are still very rigidly Baptist, you know, but it is what it is. We still love each other.
Philip Eumanns wrote and directed Burning Cane. Philip, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Burning Cane is available now on Netflix. Up next on The Frame, life as a warm-up comedian.
Doing warm-up in the settings that I did, which were talk shows that have a human being's name in the title and their stars, my job was to set the table for them and not make it about me. You know, your job is to be funny and then hand over the baton to the star and let them run with it.
I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. When you watch a sitcom or a talk show or anything with a live studio audience, if the audience is really laughing, even for some lame jokes, that's known as a warm crowd. And that's because somebody warmed them up. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving wanted to find out just who are those people who pump up the crowd.
A few months ago, I got free tickets to a taping of a sitcom pilot starring Hamilton alumnus Leslie Odom Jr. We had to arrive at CBS Studio Center several hours early, go through security, wait, and wait, and wait. We finally get into the studio, sit down, and then this presumably 23-minute sitcom episode took more than 4 hours to tape. The only reason the audience kept laughing take after take was this guy.
Let's see if I can get you guys focused. Let's all try one clap as a group on the count of three. Ready? One, two, three! What the heck? Great energy. She's up there like, "Woo!"
Ron Pearson has been a warm-up comic for 31 years, an unseen but invaluable presence at thousands of hours of American television. This was a recent taping for the Netflix show Fuller House on the Warner Brothers lot.
Listen, this is called a sitcom. It's short for situation comedy. This is different from every other form of television. Listen, in that in a sitcom, you guys are the most important people here. Say what?
Pearson started out as a champion juggler and worked as a street performer in France when he was young.
If you took Cirque du Soleil and stripped it down to maybe 7 or 8 performers and had a storyline and developed clown characters for each person, that's what we were doing. And I didn't speak French, but I learned the whole show in French. Qu'est-ce que tu faisais par terre?
His job as a warm-up is to get the audience in a good mood and laughing. But this isn't a stand-up comedy gig. He's there to establish the rules and keep everyone in line.
Rule number one is if something's funny, what do? Laugh, right? You're here to laugh because we're filming in front of a live studio audience, and literally your laughter will be heard around the world. Pretty cool, huh? Rule number two is just as easy. If you're not sure if it's funny, what do? Right, laugh anyway.
He's there basically to cheerfully guide a bunch of hungry, tired strangers, sometimes huge fans of the show, sometimes a busload from a rehab house, through what can, ironically, be a tedious, soul-crushing slog.
Sometimes a show has so much energy and so much popularity and so many good stars that I just push the snowball at the top of the hill and the snowball goes. And it builds and builds through the night because the show has so much going on. And then some shows, I'm pushing a boulder up a hill.
Come on!
As the hours drag on, Pearson breaks out the big guns, juggling, perching precariously on the railing, and balancing a full-size ladder on his chin.
You know, you're the court jester. It's your job to keep the energy and the mood light.
It feels like a hostage situation. By hour four, I think I would murder people.
Jimmy Pardo is a stand-up comedian and longtime podcast host. For 6 years, Pardo was Conan O'Brien's warm-up guy. Work that's pretty different from warming up a sitcom audience.
And they're still getting up and going, "Who's got a joke? You know, come on, who wants to get it? We got a dance contest going," and they're doing anything they can to keep that energy up. And I admire that because, again, I think I would just walk down if I was on the set of Friends, tell Matthew Perry, go F this, and I'm done.
He says warm-up comics are critical to the machinery of these shows working, but there's historically been a stigma about the work.
I think it's made a turn. I think not unlike cruise ships, like, you know, when your career's over, you went and worked on the cruise ships for old people and so on and so forth, but the cruise ships have taken a turn, and they're now hiring hip, relevant comedians. I think the same thing has kind of happened with warm-up. I think it went from guys that you'd go, "Oh, that guy can't work the clubs, so he does warm-up." I think that that's also taken a turn. It's not as frowned upon as it was 10 years ago, even.
Pardo is very funny. He's also very good at playing second or even third fiddle.
Doing warm-up in the settings that I did, which were talk shows that have a human being's name in the title and their stars, my job was to set the table for them and not make it about me. Your job is to be funny and then hand over the baton to the star and let them run with it.
Occasionally, Conan called Pardo over to the couch.
You left my show. You are in my employ. You're supposed to stick around for a while.
And I always do, sir.
Yes, but you left last night, and I'm worried about you. It was a medical emergency. What happened?
What are you, Gladys Kravitz? Who cares what happened to me?
For warm-up comics like Ron Pearson, they may not be in the spotlight of your favorite show, but you'd sure notice if he wasn't around.
A lot of people say, "Oh, all the sitcoms are canned laughter." Well, they're not.
Well, that was embarrassing. Who knew indigestion could feel just like childbirth?
And it ain't easy.
I come home often with splitting headaches up the back of my head, very tired. And by the way, I'm deaf in one ear and 30% deaf in the other. So I talk really loud generally. So I push my voice way too much. I actually text my wife before every show and I say, starting the battle.
And all for the sake of laughter. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that'll do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. And also a reminder, this show is a daily podcast, so you can subscribe and listen at your convenience. You can find us through all the leading podcast sources and on the KPCC app. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you tomorrow.